Hello, Keta. You heard a Kamlo Dateline Pacific, long RNZ Pacific, Mikoroy Hawkins. Coming up.
C'est nous qui allons commander chez nous, parce que c'est nous qui allons être maîtres de notre destin.
New Caledonians are preparing to vote again on independence from France. Also,
none of these little islands are completely free of risk, and we need to ensure that our border policies are robust.
The New Zealand Labour Party is wary of opening the border for Pacific RSE workers from COVID-free countries, and Bougainville welcomes Rio Tinto coming back to the table on Panguna mine damage. New Caledonia will have its second referendum on independence from France this Sunday amid expectation of a final showdown to come in 2 years. All along, the campaign has involved a glance towards 2022, when a third and final referendum is likely to be called to wrap up a decolonization process sought by the indigenous Kanak people. Walter Zweifel covered the last referendum in 2018, and I asked him why there are three referendums.
It's because of the terms of the Nouméa Accord, which was drawn up in 1998 between the anti- and pro-independence parties and the French state. After a gradual and irreversible transfer of most powers from France to New Caledonia, a referendum could be called at the earliest in 2014, but no later than 2018. The joking at the time meant that it was held at the very last moment allowed under the accord. The vote was, as we know, no, but the accord allowed for a new referendum within 2 years if independence was rejected, and that's why there is a fresh vote this Sunday and probably a third in 2022.
Which side do you think is likely to win?
Well, judging by the rhetoric, it seems that most people expect another rejection of full sovereignty. The pro-independence side says it hopes to do better than in 2018, while the key anti-independence groups already talk about proposing a new statute in 2022 instead of having a third referendum. Importantly, there have been no published opinion polls this year. Before the last referendum, polls suggested a rejection rate of about 70%. But in the end, less than 57% of the electorate opposed independence.
What are the arguments for independence?
Like the people in other Melanesian countries, the Kanaks want to end the colonial era. Since 1986, New Caledonia has also been on the UN decolonization list. At the recent rally, Rokwamita, who signed the 1998 Nouméa Accord and who is the current Congress president, said Kanaky New Caledonia was ready to go it alone.
It's us who should be in charge here because we should be masters of our destiny.
Well, the FLNKS is adamant that it wants an inclusive country on good terms with France.
And what is the argument for staying with France?
Well, France is being seen as a guarantor of basic rights and also as a backstop for the economy. The nickel industry, which is the backbone of the economy, is in difficulties and over the last years needed to rely on the French state to stay afloat. There are also several other elements at play, such as a wish to belong to a larger power. One senior politician, Philippe Dunoyer, said he would like the people to become French Caledonians and he urges a dialogue.
For 30 years, we've walked together on the basis of two principles. One, dialogue, and two, a search for consensus. Why wouldn't it be possible after 1988 and 1998 to find this path again?
And what is the French position?
Well, officially, France defines itself as a neutral arbiter. It's also the organizer of the vote. The government issues no voting recommendations, and none of the big parties advocate independence for New Caledonia, while the parties on the right call on their supporters in New Caledonia to stay French. In the background, France is seen as keen to maintain New Caledonia as a strategic outpost. Just as the referendum process began 2 years ago, President Macron included New Caledonia in his so-called Indo-Pacific Axis, which also includes Australia as a counterweight to China. And coincidentally, France's first ambassador for the Indo-Pacific will assume office next month.
So what are the prospects coming out of all of this?
Well, assuming there will be a no vote again, the two sides will need to find an accommodation. It appears that the FLNKS would opt for a third referendum, while the rival side, the so-called loyalists, want to replace it with a vote on a new statute which would tie New Caledonia into France. As we can see, the positions are entrenched.
And what about if there is a yes vote?
Then there's going to be a transition period of several years. There's already an outline by the French government how this would have to work. In essence, New Caledonia would lose its financial support that is in place now. And another thing that is of importance, there would be New Caledonian citizens, which means that France would have to draw up a law and decide who of the people in New Caledonia would be allowed to remain French.
That was Walter Twyford reporting. The New Zealand Labour Party is wary of calls for COVID-free nations to provide workers for the coming summer fruit harvest. That is because it is sceptical of the COVID-free status of these countries, most of which are in the Pacific. As a result, it's unwilling to relax bans on summer harvest workers from those countries, despite being urged by growers and the National Party. Eric Frickberg reports.
Fruit left to rot on trees. That's what fruit growers and other summer produce harvesters fear will happen if they don't get enough workers to pick their crops this summer. COVID-19 restrictions are blocking the arrival of workers from the Pacific Islands under the Registered Seasonal Employer or RSC scheme, and not enough New Zealanders can be found to replace them. So last week, Mike Chapman of Horticulture New Zealand proposed a solution.
If we could, from COVID-free countries, get a flow of RSC workers back, that would be the ultimate solution.
In other words, only bring in RSC workers from COVID-free countries. The World Health Organization lists both Solomon Islands and Vanuatu as not having reported cases of COVID, and both nations have traditionally supplied RSC workers for New Zealand. But Labour's agriculture spokesperson Damien O'Connor is concerned about the veracity of their COVID-free status.
None of these little islands are completely free of risk, and we need to ensure that our border policies are robust and that we don't allow COVID to come into the country with RSC workers or anyone else.
Damien O'Connor went on to suggest that some island states might not always keep good official records about what diseases they actually have.
We are not over the border controls that they have in each of these countries. Many are not as robust as New Zealand, so we're mindful that, you know, there may be COVID in some of these countries. And as we know, every week the situation with COVID changes and the risk profile does as well.
Horticulture New Zealand declined to be interviewed on this, saying its earlier position was unchanged. But the National Party's agriculture spokesperson David Bennett says Damien O'Connor's worries could be answered by taking extra precautions.
There's two tiers to it. You know, it's got to be a COVID-free country and a country with a good history in that regard. And then secondly, there's going to be the requirements around the entry and testing and contact tracing and such like. That way, we'll be endeavouring to cover all bases as much as we can.
Richard Clarkson is president of the Motueka Fruit Growers Association. He says his members will definitely provide quarantine to give confidence to any essential workers they can get.
We've got space and we've got facilities to be able to quarantine them on site. It's the ability to get them into the country is our biggest issue to start with, but we can actually put things in place to make sure that we can guarantee their quarantine and their safety. We don't want to put our RSC workers at risk because they are a lifeline to the industry, really.
Richard Clarkson says horticulture kept going throughout the first lockdown and it could do so again as long as it has enough workers.
That was Eric Frickberg reporting. One of the Bougainville community members heading a complaint over Panguna mine damage has welcomed Rio Tinto's willingness to talk. The new MP, Theonila Rokamatbob, says the destructive effects of the Panguna mine in central Bougainville are still being felt more than 30 years after it shut down. She and 155 others, with the help of the Australian Human Rights Law Centre, has placed a human rights complaint with the Australian government. The mine's majority owner, while it was in production, Rio Tinto, has previously rejected any responsibility, but now says it is willing to meet with stakeholders and discuss the issues. Don Wiseman spoke with Mrs. Matbob about the latest developments.
Well, basically, what I want them to do really is when coming on a round table, because, you know, we have a lot of historical matters to sort out. We want the Rio Tinto to come on the table and at least hear the grievances of the people. And I really must appreciate the positive gesture which Rio has given by acknowledging the complaint that there is a possibility, and I'm very much looking forward to that so that at least we hear what Rio would say about the complaint. We can also have the opportunity to present the grievances of the people, the rightful person.
In the past, of course, Rio has been very emphatic about it was nothing to do with them. They said they followed the law as it applied back then, and then, of course, they walked away. But do you think Rio has had a change of heart because of what happened in Australia and the criticism they faced over the destruction of a sacred historic site for Indigenous people there?
Probably that is also part of it, but I believe that maybe it is the right timing that such things have to be ironed out, and given also the pressure that is coming from the Indigenous people of Australia, which was something I wasn't aware of. So maybe this is the right time when all of us should definitely come on a round table, and probably these are some of the things that have given Rio the conscience, I mean, the decision to make, that at least they would also take up the responsibility to talk on the round table with the community and also other stakeholders, because the issue of, especially the issue of Bougainville, is not something that we can say that Rio will stand alone on this. We'll also require the colonial administration and churches involved in the old development process of what is continuing to affect the people on Bougainville.
Can you just take us back as to what the impacts are right now in terms of the people within your district? What are the impacts of the Panguna mine aftermath currently on your people?
Well, currently, the continuous impacts that's still happening in that in Bougainville, the waste that was created by the operation is actually continuing to cover the arable land areas, which were never in the mine lease or the boundary of the project. And the people keep moving away, and then even the water sources, which are very vital things, you know, for the survival of a person, they are poisoned as we speak today. And even the fertility of the land, there is so much hunger right now as we speak. So people have to work extra hard or even move to other people's land areas. There is land shortages. There is also, apart from poisoning of the water sources, there are health impacts, people having skin infections and diseases. These are some of the impacts that were never felt by the people, but given continuous impact with the movement of the collapsing of the levees and then the covering of arable land areas, these are terrible conditions which people are impacted, as with not just that constituency that I represent. The impact of what has been left behind by Rio Tinto is actually impacting 5 constituencies.
Bougainville MP Theonila Roca Matbob. And that's Dateline Pacific from RNZ Pacific. Thank you to Maswahere Kam. Looking to follow next time more.